Let's do this. The Cult of Hockey podcast by the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David.
So, Bruce, big news. The Oilers have a new GM confirmed.
All but signed, sealed, and delivered, but it's clearly happening based on what we heard from...
Based on what we heard from Ryan Detroit. And other people.
We heard from Detroit that he submitted his resignation. Sorry about that. Phone rang. I've got so there's no other outcome. But I was kind of expecting a neat and tidy bow that there'd be a nice press conference this morning at 10 o'clock with Bob Nicholson and Ken Holland sitting around a table. Instead, the news came out during Game of Thrones last night that basically it was a done deal, and I guess we'll probably get the presser tomorrow.
Yes. Well, so, I hope Holland's time with the Oilers ends better than the Game of Thrones series. It's been really super weak. Anyway, let's not get into that. Let's get into Bruce. Let's start with Twitter. We're going to talk about Holland's record in some detail today and get into the early moves he has to make with the Oilers, including personnel and hiring a coach. We're also going to be talking about his signings, draft record, all that kind of thing. Bruce, let's start with the reaction on Twitter. Because when this story broke on Sunday, there was an immediate reaction in Edmonton. And it kind of, it's all kinds of fans, so the reaction was diverse. But it ranged from, I would say, mildly positive to profoundly, almost bitterly negative. Lots of negativity, Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
I would characterize it from the same people who were always critics of Chiarelli. Generally speaking,
we're always critics of the other guys. And
yeah, I guess they think they can all think they can do it better.
Well, and I mean, unfortunately, the history shows that the Oilers have had weak management for quite a long period of time now. So all of their many critics have lots of grist for their mills.
That's for sure.
But to pre-criticize the next guy and just assume the worst, that's the part that kind of gets my goat.
Well, I do think it sets you up for confirmation bias and being kind of a bitter fan who I will mute on Twitter. But that's if people want to be that fan, that's fine for them. They can do that. I do think there's no shortage of things though when it comes to Holland to be critical of, and it is true that the Detroit Red Wings have gone downhill and have become a capped out bottom end team the last few years. So. That's the headline. If you want it, and I wrote a headline like that on a post I wrote on Friday, essentially, that since his last really good draft pick, I would say his last exceptional draft steal in 2004, Johan Franzen, they have really suffered in Detroit by poor drafting and then some questionable decisions for a while. That said, Bruce, a little closer look at his record shows that I think he's kind of changed course dramatically since July 2007 and that kind of trading season. So two years of hockey and two summer seasons, he's completely changed direction. And we're going to get into that. Let's start though with some of the comments on Twitter. So we'll start with, here's John Bucci Gross. He's a U.S. sports writer, is he not?
Yes.
Fairly famous one. I think he works for ESPN or did.
Yes.
Anyway, here's what he wrote.
Very famous one.
Ken Holland jumping into the cold and perilous management waters of the Edmonton Oilers inspires me. The cushy, easy thing would be to stay in Detroit and coast. Doesn't fit him. Holland is a grinder, focused and impervious to ease. I hope he kills it and helps bring McDavid a cup. Then he continued on. I think money has little to do with Ken Holland's decision. He's got money. This is about a life of ease or jumping back into the fire again in a situation that outside of 1997 is not ideal. Western Canada and $5 million were nice ornaments. He's ultra competitive. What do you think of that take, Bruce?
Well, ultra competitive sounds good to me. I'm happy with his what you described of his end of season presser, like he says the right things. Sounds like he says them in English and with a smile on his face, at least occasionally. So there are things, you know, the one thing about Ken Holland coming here is that this is the one guy that certainly does have a track record for us to examine and to both criticize and praise.
Yeah, there's no shortage of grist for the mill right now, actually. There's lots of digging to do. And if you want to do an assessment, of course, he's been hired, so it's kind of late. But it does give us a sense of where he's been. And if he does adjust, because I think the big question about him, Bruce, is can he adjust? Can he change his ways? Because things weren't going well in Detroit. And can he get out of that rut? So here's a comment from Corey West. I think he's in Arizona, at West Corey. And definitely in the camp that criticized Shirelli. How many times will we hear the Detroit model in the next coming weeks? When really, the Detroit model was really just crushing three drafts. So Corey's making a point that Detroit's success really fundamentally is all based on three amateur drafts. I think it's more like four or five, actually, which is
sounds like the Edmonton model.
Yeah, that was the Edmonton model in the 1980s, and it is a hell of a model, Bruce. There's no better model than crushing it in the draft. So you can't really
3 years in a row. In
and he
case.
Was the head of amateur drafting at the time. So now. As we know from the Oilers in the 1980s, someone who leads amateur drafting can fall off the face of the earth when it comes to his draft picks, because Barry Fraser went from the best ever to maybe the worst ever in his career with the Oilers. All right, let's keep going. Here is Ben, at Ben and Yeg. Oilers Twitter is like Days of Our Lives.
This was great.
You can leave for 10 years, come back, and Marlena is still possessed. Stefano is trying to kill John Black. Bo and Hope are trying to get their love back. And the Oilers need a competent management group while fans eat each other alive in speculation.
He isn't far wrong. Now, I don't know Days of Our Lives.
No, neither do I, but I think
The Young and the Restless is the soap opera of choice in our household, of which I watch about 5 minutes a year, but I recognize the same storylines to sort of keep in place for 40 years in that case, I think it is.
Oh, we sure have had the same storylines for the last, ever since actually Kevin Lowe left as GM, I think. You know, I think he was the last really, truly competent manager running the team. And it's been a bit of a mess since.
And then. Kevin Lowe in 2007 and 2008 was trying to do what Ken Holland tried to do after Detroit's talent vein petered out. He kept trying to do these emergency fixes by chasing giant whales like Thomas Vanek and
Nylander and
Danny Heatley and
Hossa Heatley.
But throughout the little team that could era with no limited budget, he was very good, and he almost completely hit it out of the park in 06, the first year of the salary cap, when he took advantage of some team's salary cap issues. Yeah. But
let's move on to Beer League Hero, Bruce. At Beer League Hero says, I hope Ken Holland wears all of his Stanley Cup rings. The media availability, introducing him as the new GM of the Oilers. So he's trolling fans, I think, because there's this, you know, the fans that don't like him will say he's just riding on his past four Stanley Cup wins and yesterday's man.
But here's the thing, though. He knows the thing about winning from a general manager's chair. It's not like he won as a player 20 or 30 years ago and is trying to superimpose those lessons onto an entirely different job. He's done this job and succeeded at it, and that has value. I don't know how it doesn't.
Here's another Oilers fan, Jason at Alberta Oil Fire. He says, I will support Holland until he gives me a legitimate reason not to. I definitely don't understand cherry picking things in his past to complain about. Name me a GM with longevity that never made a bad deal or signing.
100%.
I'm more like 50-50 on that, Bruce, because I want to see trends, because I do think people can go up and down in their careers. Mm-hmm. And they could be strong for a long time, and then they're kind of coasting. So is he still hungry? Is he still making the right decisions? Is he still learning, adapting? So, you know, going into when I was first hearing his name, I had a pretty negative reaction because his troubles and Detroit's troubles are well known. They're a capped out team. It's crappy. They haven't had a lot of success in the draft for a long time. Some bad signings of bad contracts. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to bring up that stuff and to question the decision. But at the same time, to think about his attributes and to try to have a serious look and has he changed? What did he get right in the past? What does he bring to the table that might help the situation now?
Right. No, I'll wear him 100% is this. I will support Holland until he gives me a legitimate reason not to.
Gotcha.
And his other comment was talking about cherry picking. If, as you suggest, you look at the whole record, the good and the bad, yeah, absolutely. Of course he analyzed the whole record. But just saying, well, he stinks because the last 5 years Detroit has gone downhill is maybe not giving full credit for how damn high that hill was for how long before that. And it's as for him not being hungry, well, it was an easy decision for him to just stay in Detroit and ride the wave right into the Hall of Fame where you know he's going. And he's taken on this challenge. So presumably, if he's not hungry and he's doing that, then, you know, it doesn't even add up.
Well, he doesn't look like Sleepy Ken to me. Like from his press conference, he was spitting piss and vinegar, Bruce. Like he was chomping at the bit, mm-hmm. absolutely passionate, chomping at the bit to rebuild the Detroit Red.
I liked a lot of his sort of underlying rationale of what he valued.
Yeah, he had said a lot of really good things, didn't he, Bruce, in that press conference about his
understanding. Defenseman that can skate and move the puck, for example.
And he's seen so many drafts. He's seen so many, and like he knows how hard it is to develop these guys into the NHL players, even after they've been drafted. And he just knows how fraught that is, and presumably he knows how to make it right or make it wrong in terms of doing that. Now, of course, he hasn't done it in a long time with especially on defense in Detroit. They haven't developed many good defensemen in that organization for the last 10, 15 years. So, I mean, since Johan Eriksson and Kyle Quincy and Nicholas Cronwell. So okay, here's Jeff Follett at Jeff Follett. I think he's a Toronto sports fan. He's a blogger. And he says, and I don't mean that as a pejorative to call him a Leafs fan.
Leafs and Marlies. He's an expert on the Marlies.
Yeah, I think he is a fan. And that's
and he's a fan. He's a fan blogger like us.
And he says, the Oilers will never, ever figure themselves out. All this talk about deep examination, self-reflection, and interviewing people with plans, all to ultimately throw cash at a guy who didn't interview, whose philosophies are the exact same as the status quo, with ties to the boss. That's a pretty good summation of the negative take on the hiring of Holland. Now, we don't know if this suggestion, Jeff Follett, all due respect, does not know if Ken Holland did or didn't interview with Nicholson. No one knows. That's not been reported, has it, Bruce?
No, it hasn't been reported. And it's hard to imagine there wasn't some kind of exchange. As for having the exact same hockey philosophy, I'm not sure that I buy that. It's like,
it's not, right. That's all, not
let's,
correct.
Let's stereotype them and put them all in the box. I mean, they may be from the same generation or, you know, what have you, but it doesn't necessarily mean they think the exact same.
And Bruce, come on, like this is an incorrect statement, is the truth. Because all of these years, what we've known about Detroit was, and what they were hailed as, is taking risks on smaller skilled players in the draft mm-hmm. and hoping those guys will fill out, that Nicholas Lidstrom will put on 20, 30 pounds, and Datsyuk and Zetterberg the same. Mm-hmm. And these guys, they just again and again and again take risks on these little skinny guys and see if they'll pan out. And remarkably, or not remarkably, maybe predictably, they did. And so this is a guy who clearly was never in the heavy hockey camp. He went for what the analytics, so-called analytics crowd, went heavily in favor of a skill approach to hockey. That's what they wanted to see. Well, Holland was at the forerunner of that way before they were. With them, you know, he didn't have analytics, and And I don't know how much of the predilection for skill with the analytics people is just kind of a, you know, maybe there's people who like skill also like analytics. I don't know if they're related actually, but anyway, he's always liked skill. So I don't think Jeff's right about
well,
that.
Well, heavy hockey. I remember one time writing a post and researching the number of fighting majors around the NHL. And Detroit was dead last in the league for like 8 years in a row or something. It was like, it just stood right out. Like other teams would have 30, 40, 60 fights and Detroit would have 12, you know, and that just, I mean, not that fights equal heavy hockey, but there's obviously some overlap between the two and what is valued as, you know, contributing to the team's success. And clearly Detroit didn't see dropping the mitts and throwing punches as something that was of value to them. And they were very successful without that capacity.
All right. Here's Oilers Junkie at Oilers Junkie. And his tweet is Oilers Now. And he's referring to Bob Stauffer's show. Oilers Now this coming Monday. And the Oilers Twitterverse will complain about the Holland hire. But I'll tell you what, the guy knows how to build a winner. And then he's going ahead to Oilers Now 2020. No one could have seen this coming. Which is, so Bob's in a tough position, right? He works for the team. He's got to put an Oilers friendly positive spin on it. So even if he doesn't like moves made by Shirelli, he's not at liberty to say it. Is completely right. Said he can hint at it or be muted in praise, but he can't really come out and blast. But so anyway, that's a funny.
It was funny. Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
I give points for humor, even if I don't agree with the underlying pretext. So certainly it's a possible future that we've seen come to pass in the past.
Yes. Okay. Here's Gord Miller at Gord Miller TSN. When the Oilers circled back with an offer this week, Ken Holland called friends in the game to get their thoughts. One of them warned him about the poisonous atmosphere around the team. "You'll get killed on social media," he warned. "I'm not on social media," Holland replied. So what do you make of that?
Well, probably good self-defense maneuver for any of these guys to not be on social media because it can get toxic at times. I was a little surprised, mildly disappointed in Gord Miller with his Edmonton background to be making a comment like that. But it's not without some cause. Obviously, there are days.
Bruce, the Oilers Twitter has been plagued with a higher percentage of hockey fans who believe they should be GM than any other fan base in the NHL. I think that's our fundamental issue is we have like maybe in some fan bases, there's between 1 and 25% of fans who think they should be at BGM or are smarter than the GM. And in Edmonton, it's 50% or all.
Well, if you're going to go with think they can do a better job than the GM, then you're starting with a lower bar in Edmonton than you are in other places based actual performance. So
that's the other reason for the poisonousness. Now, of course, Gord is reporting here. Like when I read the quote again, you know, when I read it at the time, I was a little bit hot about it. But now reading it, he's just reporting something that happened, right? And I do love Holland's response. I think players are insane if they're on social media. They are insane to be on social media. It is way too negative. They should not be there. And GMs and coaches, they shouldn't be there either. I mean, they're not. Just stay away. Just stay away.
It's a good way to communicate. There's a lot going for it, but you know, some days it's anti-social media. You know,
it's so fans are so up and down and toxic and happy and crazy and all over the place. I don't think there's a lot to be gained from it. Let's go with Dean Millard at Duck Millard. Does anyone else think hiring Ken Holland is a little like Shirelli? Like Shirelli, Holland has won it all more than once, but he also has put the Wings in a bad spot cap-wise, like Shirelli did in Boston and Edmonton. I think Holland is a smart man, but I see similarities. What say you?
Hi, Dean. I also say Holland, like Detroit was number one in the NHL in cap hit this last year. Yeah. Like $86 million, and no other team was over the $79.5 million. But that said, they had three long-term injury situations, two of them like permanent with Zetterberg and Franzen, I think it was.
Yeah.
And only Mike Green that kind of went on long-term reserve during the season. So he was working knowing that he had that cushion all year long. So it's kind of deceptive that way. They are going to be clearing some contract, expiring contracts. I understand $15 million coming off the books this year and $15 million next.
A lot of money, yeah.
And yeah, which I wish the situation applied in Edmonton. Like he's got some heavy lifting to do here to deal with next year's cap, and I'm going to be writing about that. Clearly things have not gone well for the Red Wings. They missed the playoffs, was 3 years in a row now, and just sort of bottoming out. But partly that's just the cycles of life, right? I mean, in the game of hockey.
He reminds me, this reminds me more, Bruce, of the Glenn Sather signing, the New York Rangers signing Glenn Sather in 2000. Glenn Sather had been fantastic GM, had some not doing so well when the situation changed in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. Due to money, he hadn't been able to adapt, which is a pretty big factor at that time. I mean, it was a huge factor. But Sather, you know, he was kind of struggling along and doing okay. And, you know, maybe that's what we could say about Holland. But two people with impeccable credentials, you know, absolutely the top credentials in some ways, and all kinds of success in the past. But a little longer in the tooth and not the young. If you're looking for the young tiger to come in here, and I think that's what I honestly wanted. I think deep down was that find that guy. Find Glenn Sather in 1978, not Glenn Sather in 2000, you know? That's who I was hoping they'd find. It's pretty hard to find Glenn Sather in 1978, and maybe you got to get a little lucky to be Glenn Sather from 1978. Okay, let's go now. Here's Wheaton Oil, at Wheaton Oil. People are worried that Holland is Chia 2.0, and there are similarities, especially in contracts and such. I also have major reservations about Holland. I'll say this, though. If Edmonton has Holland instead of Shirelli in 2015, they're not in the spot they're at today. I say that because Holland doesn't trade a first and a high second for Reinhardt. He doesn't trade Hall for Larson. Chia had many faults, but those types of trades were the real backbreakers. Nothing in Holland's history suggests he makes those trades, while those trades weren't new for Chia. And I think that is a completely fair and accurate comment to make. Although he did trade draft picks, I believe, Holland to in the now and then in the push to make the playoffs.
Right. You know? Yeah, before 2016, he used to trade picks for players. And then the last couple of years, he's done it the other way around. And he's traded out players for picks.
So it's possible he might have made the Reinhardt trade, but I don't think he would have gone for a player like Griffin Reinhardt. Right. I don't think that player was in his wheelhouse, but he might have traded
for a player like Adam Larson. Not for
he would not have, and or Manning, or like, you know, Chia was all about the heavy hockey, and then he talked about getting puck movers, and he drafted Caleb Jones and Bouchard, and he signed Sekera, but he also when he traded Taylor Hall, he didn't get an elite puck mover, and certainly Manning and Petrovic were heavy hockey disasters. They've made heavy hockey a really really bad name in Edmonton right now. Okay.
Oh, and Lucic.
And Lucic, of course. All right. Let's go on from there now, Bruce. Let's get into Holland's record. And so here's what I want to say. Let's start with his draft record. And going back to what Corey West was saying, Oilers fan Corey West, about Holland's record being based on three drafts. And there's some truth to that, Bruce. So there was this fabulous 1989 draft, where they got Mike Sillinger in the first round, who played 1,049 NHL games. Nicklas Lidström in the third round, who is one of the top 10 NHL players of all time.
Yep.
Played 1,564 games. Sergei Fedorov, one of the great players of his era, 1,248 games. Dallas Drake, who played 1,009 games, they got. And they got... they got Vladimir Konstantinov, Bruce, who played only 446 games, but because of a car accident, cut his career short. He would have played 1,000 games.
He would have been a fifth guy at 1,000 games. He was a wonderful player.
So they got four guys who played 1,000 games in the NHL in that one draft. Next year, next 2 years, they take Kozlov and Primo. Great year. Year after that, they take Martin Lapointe, who played 991 NHL games, and Mike Knuble, 1,068 NHL games. They took Chris Osgood, who played 744 NHL games. The year after that, they take Darren McCarty, 758 games. The year after that, Anders Ericsson, 572. Then they take, the year after that, Thomas Holmstrom, 1,026. Matthew Dandino, 868.
Wow.
They have three bad drafts in a row after that, but then they get Pavel Datsyuk in the sixth round. Then they take the next year Henrik Zetterberg in the seventh round.
Well, and which part of that time was Holland himself sort of directly overseeing the amateur draft?
Most of it, Bruce. So until 90, I think he takes over as GM in 90, was it 97, 98? What is it? Yeah.
Yeah, but before that, he was working in there.
So all of those really great drafts, Ken Holland's running that show. Now, here's the thing. From about 2004 until they changed draft chief scouts, I think the last 3 years, Bruce, they've done pretty well. They've got a really good, like, it's always hard to tell, right?
Yeah.
But they have a lot of young players who seem to be trending really well, including a great young attacking defenseman, Philippe Hronek. And another one, Dennis Cholowski. We still don't know, of course, how their two big first-round draft picks the last 2 years, Philip Zadina and Michael Rasmussen, are going to turn out. And that's absolutely crucial for that franchise. But they had a really dry spell of about 10 years where they had limited help in the draft. And that's what killed this team. And it wasn't actually Håkan Andersson, the great Swedish scout. He didn't take Lidström. He wasn't in charge in that draft. It was a different Swedish scout. Andersson comes on when his first big find is Holmstrom. But I think one of the issues was Håkan Andersson was chief scout of the Detroit Red Wings, and he had about 20 picks in that dry spell, Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't hit on many of them. He hit on just a couple of them. Maybe, you know, it wasn't bad, but he didn't find that really great European player again. I mean, he got a couple of good players like Kalle Järnkrok. Thomas Tatar, but he didn't find the next. And so, I mean, how hard is it to find the next Datsyuk or the next Zetterberg?
Gus Nyquist. Yeah, well, those guys aren't exactly falling off trees. And he did well to get as many truly outstanding ones as he did. I mean, the story on Håkan Andersson is that he was in the Detroit system for a while. And finally, 1 year, they gave him a draft choice. Said, okay, you get to make this pick, but it was in the 10th round. And he took Thomas Holmstrom, who went on to win four Stanley Cups. That's a pretty nice way to make a first impression.
I think that Holland may have been, like Sather was too loyal to Barry Fraser.
Yes.
I think Holland might be too loyal to Håkan Andersson.
Yes.
Now, Håkan Andersson did, I think, arguably better with his picks than Barry Fraser did in the second half of his career.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, I think that's been an issue, is they needed to get maybe a different European head scout. It's not like Anderson's been terrible though, but he just hasn't got it done really. And that's been a huge impact. And none of the scouts in Detroit, maybe all of the scouts needed changing out in the mid 2000s. It's kind of hard to do that though, when you've had this record of success with these guys, when they've been the best draft team in the NHL by far for more than a decade. And then to retire them all out probably needed to happen, because I think it's a young man's game. Scouting is a hard work game. It's like Gretzky right now. Like, he's had this success as a draft guy with Boston and Edmonton, I believe, with Edmonton. But it doesn't mean he can continue to have success going forward as an amateur scout, because I do think you burn out. I think it's a job where that really does happen. So, and I think that's what happened in Detroit with Håkan Andersson's success, and maybe with some of the other scouts in Detroit.
Yeah, well, sometimes scouts lose their edge over time, too, you know. I mean, our managing positions, like, people have a peak, and it's not necessarily something that, you know, the older they get, the wiser they get, and they just keep getting better and better. It doesn't always work that way. And, I mean, Barry Fraser, I mean, he freaking moved to Mexico halfway through his career. Pretty hard to scout hockey players from Mexico, I would have to say, especially in pre-internet days. But
okay, 5,000 bonus points, Bruce, if you can name the city in Mexico that Barry Fraser...
Wasn't it Cabo San Lucas?
San Lucas, was that it? if there's ever an indication that you might need to replace your head scout, it's when he spends his winters in Cabo San Lucas.
In a retirement villa.
They didn't have the internet then. You couldn't even watch the games. Like now you could watch junior games online. I mean, theoretically, you could do a lot of scouting that way. The Buffalo Sabres moved to that model a few years ago. I don't think it worked for them, but they moved out of it. Anyway, that was the first indication that something was wrong there. So, Bruce, let's talk about his signings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Unless you have something more to add on this.
One last point, yeah. And that's it has to do with all those trades. In 2016, he had a first and 2 seconds. 2017, he had a first, a second, and 4 third-round picks. In 2018, 2 firsts, 2 seconds, all in the top 36. So I guess he's going to have a little fresher group of prospects because he was trading into the draft pick pool instead of trading out third rounders for Alex Petrovich.
Yeah, look at the last year's draft, Bruce. Mm-hmm. 2 firsts, 2 seconds, and 3 thirds.
Oh, 3 thirds. Yeah, there you go.
So this is
picks in the top 100, 8 out of the top 100.
This is right out of the New England Patriots playbook, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea is, no, it's just a risk drafting these young guys. You don't know. You have an inkling. You hope you got it right. But you have 31 teams going over the same pool of players with a fine-tooth comb. And the best way to have success is to just give yourself, every 1 in 5 of these guys is maybe going to turn out. So why don't you increase the odds of that by getting more draft picks? And that's exactly what Ken Holland seemed to be doing here. So good for him. Smart guy in that regard. So, yeah, the trades were they traded away players like Thomas Yurko, 2017, Brendan Smith, 2017. Now, those two guys were in their 20s. Thomas Vanek, now that was more of a dumping an older guy at the trade deadline in 2017. Riley Sheehan, 2017. Peter Mrazek, 2018. Thomas Tatar, 2018. Nick Jensen, 2019. And Gustav Nyquist, 2019. Now, the thing all those players have in common with Vanek, Bruce, is they were guys in their late 20s or mid-20s that were being traded out for draft picks, which is really interesting to me. It's not what you usually see because I think GMs tend to hold on to those guys who have been in the league. They're just hoping to win with them, but he traded them out. What do you make of it?
Well, it's like I say, it's kind of the New England Patriots model. I mean, the Oilers at times have traded out at the deadline. They traded out for draft picks. There was one year they traded Justin Schultz and was it Teddy Purcell? Got a couple of third rounders at the deadline, and the years they were out of the running.
Schultz was a mercy trade, of course, and Purcell was over 30. Have the Oilers made that? Like, I mean, they've made some terrible trades.
Patrick Maroon, when the guy's contract was expiring and they didn't think they could sign him, they would cash him in, usually.
Now, I think Smith and Tatar had term left, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tatar did, and he got a first, a second, and a third for Tatar. That was an unreal trade.
So here's my thinking is that Holland looked at these players and thought, these aren't the players that are going to put us over the top. They're not player. We need to get some championship level players. Mm-hmm. And we might even have to go down in the draft to do that. So there's a certain amount of tanking going on here of acceptance that you're going to be less competitive for a few years. So that's part of what's going on. And just the idea of getting more draft picks, higher draft picks. And that's how we're going to win a Stanley Cup. He's going for the gusto, I think, in making these moves. He's realizing like his goal is to win a Stanley Cup. He made that clear in that interview, how badly he wanted to win a Stanley Cup in Detroit again. And I think he just came to the conclusion that a lot of teams did. So this was how about a soft tank that they were going through. And they did get Zadina, 6th overall. And they're going to get the 7th overall, 6th overall pick this year as well.
They're right up there
So they're going to get another really good hockey player.
Mm-hmm.
And They're losing all this cap space. Steve Yzerman isn't moving in, if we're completely honest. He's not moving into a terrible situation in Detroit in terms of, like, they still have to find those one or two outstanding franchise players. But there's cap space, there's draft picks, and maybe he's already on the roster, and maybe it's, you know, Joel Foligno or Philip Zadina or Michael Rasmussen, so we'll find out.
Right. Well, the thing is, he's moving into an Edmonton situation where I'm not sure how many assets he has that he can trade off that have value for draft picks. You know, who are they going to trade off of this roster and get a second-round draft pick, right? Zach Cassian? I mean, a lot of these guys are going to, if they do trade him, they're going to have to trade assets with him to get rid of him because their contracts are so onerous.
And Edmonton has this weird pressure in that they do have the franchise players, right? It's just building around them. So
yeah,
it's different. Weird. It's a strange dynamic. And I think it actually pushed a lot of Shirelli's moves, right? Mm-hmm. In that there's, when you have this superstar, the pressure to win now becomes different. And that's why you end up making, you know, the Lucic signing, or maybe the, you know, or a play like that, or the Reinhardt trade where you're trying to get an older player who's going to develop quicker. They just picked the wrong two players in Lucic and Reinhardt. Now, Holland himself was in that same mold, Bruce, where mm-hmm. he was trying, when he did have those superstar players, he behaved in a similar way as Shirelli. So even when they were getting older, like Datsyuk and Zetterberg getting older into their 30s in 2012, 2013, he was lavishing, you know, he signed Steven Weiss, you know, who was 30 mm-hmm. years old and Oops. Had been injured most of the year before.
Yeah.
Signed him to a 5-year deal at $4.9 million per.
That was a real bad one.
His last bad one, I think it's a bad one. It's not as bad as Weiss, but Franz Nielsen, who mm-hmm. was 32 at the time, he signed to a 6-year deal at $5.25 million.
That was the same day that Lucic and Louis Eriksson both signed.
God, there's
for
a lot
similar
of
money, and there was all these 30 guys going on, and the people were throwing 6 and 7 year deals at $6 and $5 million at them. And whoa!
He also threw a lot of money at Darren Helm and Justin Abdelkader. Abdelkader in let's see, when was that? 2015, and Helm in 2016. Now those were two players in their late 20s, I think, at the mm-hmm. time, who had been pretty good players, but they kind of went the Lucic route and have become lesser, much lesser players than they were when they signed. They didn't pan out. So yeah, when he had a hope of winning, he was certainly going for it. And then he backed off to the tank. It's, you know, there's a lot of limited options. It seems like there's kind of limited options for whoever you are as GM in the cap era of the NHL. And you just can't afford to make any screw ups. And Holland did. I don't like what he did between 2013 and 2016. I like what he's been doing since then. So that's my take on that. A note to take care of the dog or the cat there for a second. All right, let's move on and talk about Ken Holland's philosophy. So he gave a interview at the end of the year. It's kind of his exit interview from this season in Detroit, and he was still thinking about coming back and leading the Red Wings at that point, and said a few interesting things. So let me just find a couple of them here. First of all, one of his quotes was, he was talking about rebuilding the blue line, and he said, "I like defensemen who are mobile and can pass the puck."
Hallelujah.
You back?
Hallelujah. That's a wonderful thing to hear.
Yes. I like defensemen who are mobile and can pass the puck. Mm-hmm. Bruce, there wasn't one word about grit in the entire press conference or about character. Not one word about character, although it was implied throughout.
Mm-hmm.
Not one word about culture. Not like the buzzwords that I think at this point rightly drive Oilers fans crazy.
Yeah,
you were coming from.
I've had enough of that crap. I really have.
Here's what else he said. Here's one of the quotes I really love. As I look at the 2019-20 team, part of them, the defensive group, have to be young. Part of them have to be young so that one day they're old. We got to get them on the team when they're 21, 22, 23, but you can't have six of them. It's It's not fair to them. It's not fair to the fans. It's not fair to the organization. It's not fair to the team, because that's a tough position on defense. When you make a mistake, it usually leads to a scoring chance. And if you give up enough scoring chances against good players, you fish the puck out of your net.
Bingo.
So the good news for him, he's coming into a situation very much like Detroit, where they've got a lot of good young defenseman prospects who are 22, 23. And he can integrate a couple of them into the team.
Well, he can as soon as he makes room for him somehow. I mean, that's the issue, is how does he, how do you make the space happen? But he does have the potential young guys. They got a full six pack of young defensemen who are committed to playing pro hockey in North America next year, who all I would consider are legitimate NHL prospects. And they won't all make it, but they won't none of them make it, right? Some of them will. And sooner you got one or two of them integrating, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Here's another thing he said. He's, quote, "I want this team to win another Stanley Cup. I want the Red Wings to contend for another Stanley Cup, to be a cup contender. I know how hard it is to win a cup. We won four cups. We were a contender from 1993 legitimately to probably 08, 09, 010, 11. We were a cup contender from 1993 to 2011. Probably 18 years, you could say we were a legitimate cup contender. We won four. We didn't win 12. We won four. They're hard to win. Everything has got to fall right." And then he went on to say, "I'm doing what I believe is in the best interest of this franchise, of this fan base, of all those players, to try to build this team into a cup contender. That's why I get up every day. That's my challenge. That's my goal, because I love being a Red Wing. I love being a Red Wing." I like this passion there, man. And I liked his knowledge. He knows how hard it is. And he talked about in this rebuild thing, is he says you have to be patient. And I think he learned that. He took about two or three years to learn how hard it is, the rebuild thing.
Yeah.
What do you think of him?
Well, I'd argue Detroit was a Stanley Cup contender from 1991 to 2012, which is the precise length of Nicklas Lidström's astonishing NHL career. Like, that guy really was a driver. The team got way better the year he arrived, and it got way worse as soon as he left. Certainly they were, like, hard. Like, I can't think of a NHL hockey playoff draft that I didn't participate through the 90s and 2000s that didn't have like six Red Wings picked in the first round. They were always favored, whether they went all the way or they went part of the way. They were right in the hunt for that very, very long time, as he suggests.
And he was in the middle of that for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, 98. I mean, he was the head scout. Like, he was right there for all of it. And I obviously talent and superstar talent is huge in the NHL, but so is good decision making by the hockey boss. You know, hockey managers, top managers, Bruce, they set the tone for the entire organization, whatever they're in, and they make dozens of decisions, little decisions every day. And if their decisions are bad and driving everybody crazy, it all falls apart. If their decisions are consistently good, rational, and pick people up and motivate them, something special can happen. And I give Ken Holland credit for making something special happen. And watching that interview, which I recommend everyone to watch, go on YouTube and watch it. You get a sense of his abilities as a persuader, as an enthusiastic and persuader, who also has lots of good ideas. And I came out of that watching that interview. I went in down on him because of his recent record, but just it made me think about what he's been doing recently and about the skills that he does bring to the table. So I'm hopeful. I'm an Oilers fan, so of course I'm hopeful, but I'm not so convinced this is a terrible decision, put it that way.
Is he a good enough persuader to persuade the fan base that this is a real change in direction and a new day looking forward? Or is the bitterness about the old boys club and the same old, Nicholson hired one of his old buddies going to rule the day? Or is Ken Holland's force of personality enough to stir the drink?
Bruce, how can this not be? he's Mr. Red Wing. Like he is the Red Wings organization personified right now. And whatever they were doing all those years, that's what he brings. And it wasn't what the Oilers were doing all those years.
No.
Sure wasn't that. So he's the boss. He's in charge of this whole thing. Like this is a major change in direction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how you can see it as anything but that. And I think we are going to see some changes, but just him being in charge, like I could see if Keith Gretzky had gotten the job, you might think it's more of the same or some younger guy who doesn't know, but come on, Ken Holland is going to be Ken Holland. He can't be anything but. So here's one final quote. And this is from Jonathan Willis of The Athletic who found this. Yes. So hat tip to Jonathan. It's from Jason Ferris from the book Behind the Moves.
Yes, that's an excellent book.
Ken Holland said, "You're going to be tested at every turn as a manager. You're going to be tested by your patience. You're going to be tested by the owner's patience. You're going to be tested by the media. Be tested by your coach. Be tested by your players. Be tested by your peers." And of all the things, actually, that I've read, that mm-hmm. one gave me the most encouragement. And it's just a stark reminder of how much wisdom this man has accumulated and how many tests he's faced and passed. You don't win four Stanley Cups, Bruce, and not face 1,000 tests, big ones as a manager. Day after week after week after week, big tests, difficult players, difficult agents, difficult situations, a tough owner, this, that, and the other thing. And he passed them all well enough to win more Stanley Cups than any other general hockey manager of his generation.
Yeah, well, he actually won 3 as GM. He assumed the role in 97 when they just won, and they repeated. A very, very difficult feat, 98. And
did anyone else win 3 then? Maybe I was – did Lamorella win 3?
Lamorella would have won 3.
Okay.
Him 95, 2000. It took him 9 years to do it, and it took Holland – basically, I guess, 11 years, 98, 02, and 08. Dynasties in the modern NHL look a lot different than the ones that won year after year. It's just the playoff grind. It just makes it impossible.
I guess Lombardi won 2 and Bowman. Did Bowman win? No. Did they change GMs in Chicago?
Stan Bowman won 3.
Did he win 3?
Stanley Glenn Bowman. Yes, he did.
Pretty impressive.
Greatest name in hockey, Stanley Glenn Bowman, I think. His first name, he's actually literally named after the cup, Stanley Cup. Glenn, he's named after Glenn Hull, the great goaltender that sort of helped pave the way on Scotty Bowman's career. And Glenn was born the month that Scotty won his first cup. That's why he named him Stanley Bowman, named after Glenn Hall. And of course, his last name is named after the greatest coach of all time, who also happened to be the coach of Ken Holland when he took over the job in Detroit, one Scotty Bowman. So isn't that a great name? All three names are basically Hall of Fame.
Yeah, good one. All right. Let's talk about the next coach. So there was a rumor, the same guy who broke the story, the guy of Regina, is it Rod Peterson?
Yeah.
He broke the Holland thing last week.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, like, there was a rumor, talk that Dave Tippett might get the job. But Peterson was saying, no, he doesn't think that's in the cards. And it seems like it might still be pretty wide open about who Mike Babcock's name has come up.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll find out soon. I don't, I really, Todd Nelson was the coach in Grand Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
I really like Todd Nelson as a coach. I think he's one of these, he's one of these player whisperers,
mm-hmm.
A real player's coach who gets the most out of his talent. Who's in, and I think he's really underrated because there's something about him. He's kind of, not super duper well-spoken, maybe. I don't know if that's the right, not the way, he's not the sharpest dresser, maybe. Like he doesn't have the nice hair like Dallas Eakins. But man, the guy, he's had some success at the AHL level.
He's meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
That's what he is. And he's very much a player's coach. He's very much a a media's coach, I think a fan's coach, like he talks the common man's language and he pays attention to detail. I had some dealings with him when he was coaching in Oklahoma City. I a couple times went down to Calgary to watch the Barons play, and I got to interview Nelson, and also after some of the rookie games where he would be the coach. And of course, he was Oilers' interim head coach for a half season there before the McDavid lottery changed everything. And who knows how he would have done had he been given that opportunity, but he's certainly a candidate. And I think his familiarity with the GM is probably more than his of more value than his familiarity with the city, but he's actually got both.
He's now the assistant coach, associate coach in Dallas. So mm-hmm. he is in the NHL again. And mm-hmm. anyway, I think he should be, I think he should be in the running, if not the mm-hmm. favorite. That's my thought. Although there might be, I'm not an expert on all the candidates. So
another interesting name in the running. The landscape has changed just this morning with some big news out of Philadelphia, where Alain Vigneault has hired two high-powered assistant coaches in Michel Therrien and Mike Yeo, both, you know, multiple-time NHL coaches with some record of success. So those guys are off the market, but in so doing, they fired Chris Knobloch to make room for these guys. And Chris Knobloch is a guy who checks a few boxes. Coach McDavid in junior hockey, of course, and had great success there. And I'm not sure that he's, you know, I mean, I think he's, let's put it this way, he's in the mix of people that they should consider when looking for their next head coach.
Okay, Bruce, let's quickly go over the one or two moves or the general trend that challenge Holland has to face and maybe how you think he can solve it. I can start out. I just think, personally, I think what I was worried about more than anything was a GM that was going to come in and do what Aikens did, essentially, and he was the coach, but just bring in, like, discount everyone in the Oilers system, discount everything about the Oilers, and just rip it up and try to bring in his own guys. And I just think that's a terrible approach. The Oilers have a great farm system right now, or at least a good one in Bakersfield, lots of good players. And mm-hmm. I just think, and I'm really encouraged actually by Holland's patience, his approach. I think he's the right guy. I think he's going to come in and really thoroughly assess and properly assess what's going on in Bakersfield. He knows Jay Woodcroft. I just would advise him to do, I think there's very little you can do with the Oilers because of the cap situation. I don't think you can buy out Lucic. I think it's a bad idea to buy out Sekera, given the need for a top four demon, and he can be that. Russell's a possibility for a trade if you can make that happen, maybe even a buyout. But I'm not convinced about that because you also need NHL to demon, and Russell certainly is that. I think there's a possibility they can bring in one player. They can bring in a low-cost goalie, top priority, and then they can bring in one forward, either another center, a really good center to play the third line, or a good winger, top at first or second line. That's probably more like a second line winger. And in terms of acquisitions, I think that's about it. One winger and a goalie. And if he can do well on that, that would be fantastic because I think the defense corps, all the players are there that they need. They just need to let them develop. And I think he's going to let that happen. So what's your take?
Well, he comes in, takes over a roster that's kind of lopsided. I've just been working on this morning. And for 2019-20, they have 17 players under contract. By the time you calculate in a couple of buyouts, which aren't going anywhere, the cap hit is already $72.2 million for next year for 17 players. Now, the rumor cap increased to $83 million. Recent rumors say scale that back, so it might be closer to, I don't know, maybe $81 million. Whatever, that gives them like probably less than $10 million to add six players plus a little bit of leave a little room for injury call-ups and stuff. And it's not a lot, so either one or more of these bodies have to get moved out or dealt with in some way or other, or he really does have limited options.
Yeah. Who would you move?
Now, the imbalance part is...
I mean, that's the question. So who, Bruce? Like, I mean...
Well, you mentioned, I mean, Russell is one such example. Andrew Sekera, I think, is an example. Brandon Manning, I mean, how do you even move that? Like, that's just a poison pill left at the bottom of the depth chart by Chiarelli. They've got under contract of the 17, 8 are defensemen. So if you're going to make room for one or two of these young defensemen, you've already got 8 guys under contract for next year on one-way contracts, then something's got to give. So that's the real challenge. And then up front, under contract for next year, and I'm listing by natural position, they have one left winger, one right winger, 6 centers. And now, of course, some of those centers, Draisaitl, Gagne in particular, probably will play on the wing. But when it comes to actual natural wingers, they're going to have to flesh that out. And they do have a couple of in-house options in Puljujärvi and Kara, both of whom I think they will sign. But that's going to inflate that $72 million figure by some amount, because they have, you know, they obviously have to pay them. I don't think over much, but after that, they're going to have to find good depth players, and without a lot of money to do it, it's a huge challenge.
Well, I think the depth players are on in Bakersfield right now, and I just think they need to find one top guy, figure out a way to get one top guy to play with McDavid or Draisaitl on the wing, and a first or second line winger would be fantastic. They might be able to move out Lucic in a trade. I'm going to examine that a little further. They're going to have to get at least, they'd have to take the full 50% cap hit, but there's a possibility that can happen. Or they'd have to trade him for another bad contract in Louis Erickson.
Yeah, which does nothing to solve the cap issue.
Which doesn't solve the cap. It shortens the duration of it. Though, so. Anyway, Holland is very much, in some ways, like, I guess he's in a situation in terms of his Detroit years. It's not like the Detroit in 2017 where there's no superstars. He's got his superstars. You know, there was no situation like this in Detroit, exactly like this in Detroit, because the cap wasn't in place when he needed to add to the team in other years. So he could just go out and sign players. He can't do that in Edmonton. But I think he's learned about building a team under the cap in the last few years. And I think he's been doing a good job for the last 2 years in Detroit, building a team in the cap system. I like what I see. So I'm hopeful that he's going to apply the lessons some hard lessons that I think he learned in Detroit. And, come up with some decent answers in Edmonton. And I don't think we're going to see some of the bad moves that Chiarelli made in terms of focusing on heavy hockey, because that's not his inclination. So
no. Well, he's starting. I mean, he has to clear a low bar to be better than Chiarelli. Pains me to say it, but it's, you know, I mean, he started at least with a vision that proved to be not the correct vision. And then by the end, he was just trying to piecemeal these, Band-aid solutions that just piled on to the existing problems without solving any of them.
Yeah.
I mean, what a mess.
He did leave the cupboard stocked with some good prospects, Bruce.
Yes.
Peter Schrell, give him credit. And to give him more credit.
Signed Dave McDavid and Draisaitl 8 years apiece.
Yeah. And they did win one playoff series. Peter Chiarelli, which is more than, you know, that people I know they have a Hall of Fame management in Toronto right now, but it's yet to happen there. All right, Bruce, let's leave it there, man.
Okay. Sure. We'll have a probably official announcement tomorrow on Holland. Probably we'll have more to say then, but thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for being here. And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.